A February 1st forecast from the National Weather Service, sunny and cold. Today's high 26. Right now, wind is from the southwest at 9. It is sunny, 10 degrees in both Racine and Kenosha. Wind chill is minus 2. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Well, although it sometimes doesn't seem like it, we are by no means done with the COVID-19 pandemic. It is still very much with us. And in certain quarters of the world, in certain corners of our country, it is still creating all kinds of pain and disruption. And it is important for us to remember that. And it's also important for us to look back at the onset of this crisis, of this pandemic. And it is especially important for us to at least try to understand what was experienced on the front lines of the pandemic, particularly in the early going, when it was especially frightening and it was in so many ways an unknown adversary, especially in those early days when there was not as yet any sort of vaccine that could help us to combat it. One of the books that takes us back into the heart of the pandemic and helps us understand the untold cost of this pandemic is an amazing new book called Heroes Are Human: Lessons in Resilience, Courage, and Wisdom from the COVID Front Lines. The book is written by a very skilled author by the name of Bob Delaney. And you'll know a lot about Bob Delaney just by looking at his previous two books, one of them, Covert: My Years Infiltrating the Mob, and Surviving the Shadows: A Journey of Hope into Post-Traumatic Stress. Because he has explored so much of the world and experience of post-traumatic stress syndrome and experienced it himself first time, it equips him in a perhaps unique way to fashion this book, in which we hear from doctors and nurses and others who were on the front lines of the medical profession at the onset of the COVID-19 pandemic. And we hear all kinds of remarkable stories, for the most part, told in their own authentic voices. And then Bob Delaney offers his thoughts as well to help us reflect on what many of these people have experienced and the kind of lessons that we can learn. The book again, Heroes Are Human: Lessons in Resilience, Courage, and Wisdom from the COVID Front Lines, published by City Point Press. And Bob Delaney, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg.
I'm glad we can have this conversation. This is very important to you, I think, because you mention it in some detail towards the beginning. Explain how you want people to read this book, how you have put it together, and what you hope we will take away from it.
Thank you, Greg. I've been immersed in the understanding of post-traumatic stress for the past four decades. I experienced post-traumatic stress, as you said, early in life. I was in my 20s when I entered the New Jersey State Police, and I was on the job about a year when they tapped me to do an undercover job that they told me was going to be 6 months. like we were going to end organized crime in the state of New Jersey in 6 months. I guess that was a very aggressive mindset, but we learned very quickly that wouldn't happen, and it became 3 years of my life. I became the president of a trucking company in New Jersey under an assumed name, and this was deep cover. That Soprano-esque type of life that I led, I could go on for hours telling those kinds of stories, but what I experienced afterwards was post-traumatic stress, and I pushed it away. Anyone that was trying to help me understand what I was dealing with, I pushed away. And that those kinds of feelings that were inside of me, I express as times as emotional violence. I was paranoid. Everybody was telling me I was this tough guy, and I did heroic work infiltrating traditional organized crime, the mafia, and yet they didn't see me walking around my house at 2 o'clock in the morning pushing shower curtains back with my gun out, paranoid that they were coming to get me. The isolation, the anger levels that I was feeling, all telltale signs of post-traumatic stress. And I once I became more knowledgeable, I understood what was going on inside of me, and I wanted to share those kinds of feelings. And I started with law enforcement, firefighters, first responders, and then it spilled over into the military. And so for the past 4 decades, I've been immersed in learning as much as I can, but also sharing information to those who serve.
I neglected to mention, as I gave a sketch of your biography, that you received from President Barack Obama his Volunteer Service Award for the work that you did with the U.S. military and trying to help those who have experienced post-traumatic stress disorder in that sector. When you undertook this particular this project, what kind of challenge was it to be dealing with a very different sector of the human experience? And or is it maybe not as different as we might immediately assume it to be? I mean, certainly at a glance, they seem completely different, worlds apart. And yet I suspect you found all kinds of interesting parallels between the two.
Great insight, Greg, because that's exactly what was taking place. At the onset of COVID, we saw signs in front of every medical facility, every hospital, heroes work here. And it struck me that while I was given that term next to my name at times by folks, and I've been around military, cops, firefighters for years, and they would be given that title. And anyone that gets that title, I know, doesn't like it. And so that drove me to kind of, let's delve into this a little bit more, because all wars are different, yet all wars are the same. And so our healthcare community has been at war with an invisible enemy. So I took what I learned from those who serve on foreign soil and what they experienced by battling enemy that were visible, and saw the parallels that took place. You know, not all wounds bleed, and invisible wounds may cut as deep as the wounds we do see. So how do we process those? And being a student of this, I wrote a second book after my first book about the undercover job, and it was called Surviving the Shadows, A Journey of Hope into Post-Traumatic Stress. Greg, the reason I called it Surviving the Shadows, I believe we all have shadows in our lives. And I say to folks, never be afraid of a shadow, because in order for a shadow to exist, that means there has to be light nearby. So it is our responsibility to ourselves and to each other to get to that light. And providing education and awareness works. We have all seen it work. We've done it with HIV/AIDS. We've done it with alcohol. We've done it with drugs, tobacco. The more that we have knowledge, we interact with those kinds of situations in a better way. This is not about ending post-traumatic stress. This is about learning how to interact with it. So I believe we need a national education and awareness program to trauma, because Dr. Richard Mallica, the director of the Harvard Global Mental Health Trauma Recovery Program, says a very simple statement: trauma is inescapable in life. And how true. But all too often we think of it as military, firefighters, first responders, that kind of thing. We're all susceptible. This is a human condition, not a mental illness.
as you were just now talking about the kind of the light you want to shed on this, and your desire to help us understand trauma and stress, and in a sense more healthfully interact with it, I'm reminded of a nice moment in the book when you draw upon your own background in Catholic school, where a lot of Latin was taught, and you take us inside the term education and two different related Latin roots, educare, to bring up or nourish, and educere, to draw out. And that's a really lovely reminder to us that the process of educating others or being educated means a couple of different things.
Greg, great point. When I present in front of a group, I underline that I am shining the light on a subject. The answers are going to come from the seats. The folks that are immersed into that, the healthcare community will have the answers. They understand their culture. So if we shine the light on a subject matter, and this is something that needs to be, really is not only about COVID. This has been going on well before. I've come to learn that our healthcare community is very good at taking care of them, of us. They're not very good at taking care of themselves. And because of the same uniform that I used to wear, the uniform that the military wears, at times those who wear uniforms like to think of themselves as being able to leap tall buildings in a single bound. And I think scrubs and lab coats do that for our medical healthcare workers. And at times they compartmentalize so much in order to do their jobs that that compartmentalization pushes things down. And keeps them within them. Greg, I use this analogy when I do presentations. I ask folks to imagine I'm holding the biggest balloon they've ever seen full of air over my head. How do I get the air out? I can take a pin and pop it. I get the air out, but I don't have a balloon anymore. Hmm. I can let it go. It flies all over the room, goes out the back door. We don't know what happened to the balloon. But if we're patient and willing to listen to sounds we do not want to hear that may even hurt our ears, and we let a little air at a time, and it makes that screeching noise. Eventually, we get all the air out of the balloon, and we have a full balloon we can use again one day. Hmm. That's us with trauma. We need to get the air out of our balloons.
We're speaking with Bob Delaney about his new book, Heroes Are Human, Lessons in Resilience, Courage, and Wisdom from the COVID Frontlines. And by the way, Mr. Delaney, I'm not sure in my many years of doing this program, I'm not sure I've ever talked to anybody whose book was more perfectly titled. I mean, that is a wonderful title. In fact, in a couple of ways, it catches the eye, it catches the ear, but it also beautifully encapsulates what this book is all about. I want you to explain to our listeners why you're talking about track, of all things, as in track and field, at the outset of your book. It's a very, very interesting parallel that I think otherwise would never have occurred to me.
My wife, Billy, has run 25 marathons, and I get to go, and I think it's one of the greatest sporting events, because marathons can have the elite athlete and the weekend warrior athlete on the same stage, and there's no other sporting event that takes place, and there's such a great expression of the human spirit. People are running for causes and for other people, and one of the things that struck me was that when my wife trains, she understands she's going to be running 26.2 miles. So she trains for that 26.2 miles. And when the start of the race begins, she knows where she wants to be at the 10-mile point and at the 26-mile point. Yet, if we think of what our healthcare community has experienced with COVID, it was like they started a race and they just said, line up and go. They don't know how long they're going to run. They don't know how far they've got to go. And so think about how difficult that had to be. You had healthcare workers who were never afraid of bringing cancer home to their family and now had to be concerned about bringing COVID back home. You had healthcare workers who were seeing an unbelievable amount of death. While death is part of their world, not in that amount. And then they had to set up FaceTime and Zoom calls for folks that normally would have family members right there in the room with them, and they were holding those patients' hands. All of these added stressors were being put upon them, and then the amount of work that they were doing, so there was no end. And so that was the thought process behind the analogy of the race.
Explain how you connected with these particular people whose stories we learn in the pages of your book. How did you find them? How did they find you? And maybe explain also why it is these particular people and these particular stories that constitute your book. Because, of course, they are just the tip of the iceberg when it comes to heroic work beyond the call of duty performed by so many healthcare workers across the country and indeed around the world. How is it that these particular stories are the ones we find in your book?
I've been doing this kind of work, as I said, for the past four decades. And so I've been a student at the Harvard Global Mental Health Trauma Recovery, the reason that I mentioned Dr. Malika. I now present during that program. The cohort that I was a part of, there were 70 folks from around the world in the medical field. And while I am not, I have the contacts. And I've been doing work in the military. So I had contacts within the VA. All of these opportunities, and as I mentioned earlier, I was a state trooper in New Jersey, and I had the rank of detective, so I'm pretty good at kind of finding folks. And so I was able to track down and have conversations and also go to hospitals through contacts. I would go to hospitals, and they would show me how they would dress and put on all the PPE. And I would wear it for maybe about an hour. 2 hours, they would wear it for 12-hour shifts, and I would be soaking wet. And they had to take it off each time they went into a new patient. So it gave me insight into understanding. The same thing I did when I was doing work with the early days of the military. I said to General Dempsey, General Odierno, Admiral McRaven, my boots are not their boots, but I have to go where their boots go in order to have the credibility and the trust within the military group. So I would go to Iraq and Afghanistan on numerous occasions and spend time being embedded with our military men and women in order to learn what their life was like. I firmly believe that you have to be able to walk in their shoes and see what they experience. And I did the same thing, not only with doctors and nurses and healthcare folks, also with patients and people who had experienced it and their family members. Because when a family member goes through something, if someone in your family is experiencing something, Greg, you get hit with that emotional shrapnel. Out of the love for your family members, your friends, you get hit with emotional shrapnel. So it's not only the individual that's experiencing post-trauma, the entire family and surrounding friends do as well.
Absolutely. One choice that you made, and I think it's a great choice, but I would love to hear a little bit more about it, is that when we hear from these various doctors and nurses and aides, their stories from the front line, so to speak, they are told pretty much in their own voice. And there's even different typeset on the page to distinguish between their words and then your words that both precede and follow these different accounts. I'm just curious. I mean, I think a lot of other people writing a similar kind of book might have made a different choice to maybe tell those stories within, you know, their own framework and maybe carefully polish those stories to some extent. You chose not to do that. We really get these stories in the real voices of those who are sharing these stories. I'm just curious what prompted you to want to construct the book in that way.
I think it's important to hear from those who have experienced it directly versus my version of their story. So, you know, I just have to back it up to help explain it. When I was dealing with my personal post-traumatic stress as a result of that undercover job, I was introduced to another undercover agent by a FBI agent who was working my case and his case. And that FBI agent's name was Louis Free. And Louis was a street agent at the time, but he became the 15th director of the FBI. And Lou introduced me to a guy by the name of Joe Pistone, who was working in New York City and infiltrating the Gambino crime family. And the rest of the world would know Joe's name by Donnie Brasco. And when Joe and I first met, I looked in his eyes, I read his body language, and I heard his words, and I knew he got what I was going through. That was my first introduction to peer-to-peer conversation regarding post-traumatic stress. And I choose words carefully in saying peer-to-peer conversation. I used to call it peer-to-peer therapy, but I try to remove as many medical-sounding terms in this conversation as I can, because from my view, we have over-medicalized this conversation. As I said earlier, this is a human condition. And Sophocles wrote two plays about the warrior not knowing how to act after coming home from battle. After the Civil War, it was called Soldier's Heart. After World War I, shell shock, battle fatigue after World War II, flashbacks after the Korean and Vietnam Wars. And today it is referred to as post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, which is probably one of the most loosely used terms in our society. So it offered to folks that you do not get PTSD if Starbucks gets your order wrong. But we use that term so loosely. That's a diagnosis. And so my belief is you have to have post-traumatic stress before you're diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder. So how do we keep post-traumatic stress at post-traumatic stress and allow us to interact with it in a healthier way? My belief is that peer-to-peer conversations are the first roadblock that gets put up. Because, Greg, if you and I share stories with each other, you tell me your story. You give me permission to tell you my story. And then we validate our feelings so we don't feel like we're out on an island. We're the only ones going through it. And I think those are important for folks to hear. A nurse is telling me a story, in her words, is going to resonate with another nurse that is experiencing similar situations. The same thing with doctor, patients, family members. So that was the reasoning behind having their stories told in their voice.
Before we get to some of those stories, I want to draw up something that comes from the chapter of your life where you were dealing with soldiers in the military. And you say at one point, I don't remember if these are exactly your words, but they're close, that when you were visiting with soldiers, you learned that many of them were disconnected from their emotions. And I'm not sure if in the context you were saying that, you know, that's often the way it is with soldiers in many different contexts, or if it's more that when somebody has experienced this kind of trauma, that disconnection tends to occur. But either way, I'm curious if when we are into the realm of the medical profession and a very different kind of frontline and battle and trauma, that is that same disconnection from emotions similarly evident or more so or less so?
I think so, and I think it's individual, right? It's so compartmentalization takes place. If I go to a crime scene as a law enforcement officer, I'm going to compartmentalize the emotions that I'm feeling and push those down in order to do my job. The military does it on foreign soil, and healthcare community does it as well. When they walk into an operating room, I've got friends of mine who are doctors, and I'm used to seeing them in social setting, yet when I would see them in a hospital or if they're going into the operating room, they have a game face on. They have a different demeanor about them. I think we all do that in our professions. We take on an identity that allows us to be focused on what our responsibilities are. And think about those who are dealing with life and death. That's at the highest level of focus. That compartmentalizing, it doesn't allow them to have true human emotions. I got a friend of mine that's a doctor that is a gynecologist and said, never really got training with understanding, you know, the loss of a child, never got training to talk about postpartum. All of these things that become, so in order to do your jobs at times, you have to make like, you became this cold person. This is where I tell law enforcement officers, firefighters, healthcare workers, you have to be careful in the humor that we that is used. At times, it's called foxhole humor, gallows humor. It's in order to get through the situation. Yet, if anyone else hears that from the outside, they think this is an uncaring individual. That's not true. They're doing things in order to be able to lighten the moment, in order to be able to do their job. And so understanding all of these things, I think, is important, not only for us looking from the outside in, but for those that are inside. Let me use an analogy. Colonel Tim Carter, an amazing, great American, got hit in Iraq and lost both legs. And I got to spend time with Tim after he came back from Iraq and was over in Launchdol, and he was down at BAMCI, which is the Brooks Medical Facility in San Antonio. And we were talking about post-traumatic stress, and he said to me, you know what post-traumatic stress is like? It's like dieting. Some of us need to lose 5 to 10 pounds, some 10 to 20, and some of us are obese, and it changes on an hourly or daily basis. I said, Tim, what a great analogy. I'm going to use that in my presentations. Because you're giving a quantitative measure to something that can't have a quantitative measure given to it. And I said, I've been 5 to 10 pounds overweight since I came out of the womb. And I've been 10 to 20 and I've been obese. But at times, that just meant buying bigger pants. It didn't mean that I stopped living. And so how we interact with this, I think, is important.
That's really interesting. By the way, another metaphor that I really resonated with when you're talking about stress and trauma of this magnitude particularly is, you said at one point, you liken it to a scab developing over a wound, and that scab might remain nicely in place and tightly in place, but it doesn't take too much for that scab to be broken or dislodged and for a lot of pain to be created and to kind of ooze out. And I thought that is a wonderful picture for what this, in fact, can be.
Greg, not all wounds bleed, as I said earlier. And just like wounds we do see, as you said, a scab grows over it. With invisible wounds, at times there's a scab that goes over it. But it can be brought back to that original pain through triggers. A situation that's very similar. So, for example, I've worked with folks who, a good friend is either shot or killed. And then it's not only that particular situation. They may have had 10, 15, 20, 30 years ago something very similar, a family member shot or killed. And it brings them back to that point. And if those original traumas are not processed, it brings you back. Smells can trigger you back. Sounds can trigger you back. A date on a calendar, 9/11, brings us back and takes that scab off of that wound that we all felt, those who experienced it firsthand or through history, of understanding when our country was attacked.
We're speaking with Bob Delaney about his book, Heroes Are Human, Lessons in Resilience, Courage, and Wisdom from the COVID Front Lines. Your book begins in remarkable fashion after the foreword with a chapter called Human Touch, in which you evoke the name of Florence Nightingale and talk about the amazing work that nurses have done for generations before proceeding to the extraordinary challenges for nurses and others during the COVID-19 pandemic. You say at one point, every day nurses on the front line of the COVID-19 fight are stepping into a world of unknown risks. The specific story that is told in this chapter is from someone named Emily Grace. Explain to our listeners who Emily Grace is and where her specific story in this book from which it emanates.
Yeah, Emily is someone that I've gotten to know. Her family members are law enforcement officers with New York City Police Department, so I got to know her through them. Once I started putting the word out that I wanted to talk to folks, it was amazing to see how many families serve in so many ways. So I got to spend time with her, and she was in New York City at the epicenter of the COVID experience early days. And she shared her story and what she was experiencing. And I related some of those kinds of concepts earlier, but the concern that she had that she was going to infect her family was ever present in her mind and so controlling, to the point that she would take all her clothes off outside the house, put them in a bag, in the garage area, and didn't want to come in, then slept in different areas of the home, or at times even stayed at the hospital or would get a hotel room. And when you hear these stories over and over, that sacrifice that's being given, and that was the reason for also the courage word being there, right? Heroes are human, lessons in resilience, courage, and wisdom. The courage that took place from someone like Emily Grace, but Emily Grace was representative of how many hundreds upon hundreds upon hundreds of others that were doing a similar thing throughout not only our country, throughout the world. And so hearing their stories was so touching. She also underlined to me about resilience. And I think there's in understanding resilience, there's three segments to it. And I break it down into, there has to be a confrontation to the reality. You have to confront the reality. But Greg, I use the word confrontation because I think confrontation conjures up like this aggressive negative tone. We really confront because we care. So confrontation is what takes place. And then there's a search for meaning as the second part. And while we all have our own religious belief, I believe there's a spirituality to resilience. And the third part is FIA, F-I-A, flexible, innovative, and adaptive. We have to be flexible, innovative, and adaptive as part of resiliency, because you have to have plan A, B, C, D. And all of that was being represented by Emily Grace.
One of the things she talks about is the very special pain and trauma that was experienced in maternity wards during those early days of the COVID-19 pandemic, and actually for some time thereafter. She writes at one point, as maternity nurses, we were used to taking care of healthy moms and babies, but this virus does not distinguish between healthy and non-healthy people, and it struck our area very hard. As you can imagine, as a family-oriented maternal unit, our work was geared to keeping mothers and babies together all the time. But when COVID struck, we suddenly had to shut down the outside world. We were thrust into caring for mothers who were testing positive for COVID and having to separate them from their babies. Tell us more about the extent to which this was necessary and the kind of pain that this created for everybody involved.
A psychologist will tell us, the attachment theory of being separated from parents, what a traumatic event that is for a child and for a parent. And also, as you describe that, think of what that nursing unit was used to. Emily Grace has been in childcare, maternity work for years, and then was thrust into another healthcare pandemic that she had to care for people. And what they were used to were balloons, the larger percent of times, balloons and flowers, and everybody uplifted, and everybody happy that this new child has been brought into a family, and the excitement that would take place. And then all of a sudden, that work that she was doing was in a whole different way. The atmosphere changed. The environment changed. And when that happens to us, what impact it has on our whole outlook on life. And so all of these things are stressors. These stressors come in so many ways.
She also mentioned specifically in her story about how the maternity ward in which she worked, at least to some extent, had to be converted into or co-opted by the intensive care unit for those who were directly suffering from COVID, including many older patients who ultimately died. And that's what you were kind of touching on earlier, how this place that would be, with balloons and Disney characters painted on the walls is suddenly a very, very different place in which to live. And for people like Emily Grace, they were suddenly thrust into having to do work very different from perhaps what they had been trained to do. And of course, Emily Grace's story is just representative of something that occurred all over the place in hospitals across the country, where this kind of improvisation and transformation needed to occur as they sought to confront this crisis somehow.
Yeah, you described it beautifully. That's exactly what's taking place. And when environments change, and I don't want to make a big leap here, but I'm going to draw, think of the Ukraine, where 2 years ago, people were going out to get coffee. And today, they were hearing sirens go off and are hiding in bomb shelters. The environment changed. That whole experience changed of life. And when that disruption takes place, that's a traumatic experience in and of itself, added into the fear of dying, the fear of death, the fear that someone else, and then the guilt that comes for those in the healthcare community, feeling like, could I have done more? Those kinds of things I hear from those in the medical world over and over when I spend time with nurses and doctors. We're doing gifting programs now with the book, a gifting program where corporations, sport teams are gifting the books. I go and present, and the books are gifted to the nurses and doctors in a particular hospital, and I give a presentation at Grand Rounds or for a meeting. And to hear more and more stories, the tears in their eyes of saying, thank you for acknowledging this. They would tell me stories. I heard recently a story of, because COVID had caused for people not to be able to speak because they were so congested and so overwhelmed with the disease, they would write on a whiteboard, please don't let me die. Imagine seeing that. Another nurse told me that she worked in the ICU and she knew how it was taking a toll on her. She knew it. She just wanted to have a day with her husband to go out on a lake and get out on a boat. And they did, and they had a great day. But when they pulled in at the end of the day and they were going to dock, she went to the front of the boat to tie it off. And she started crying uncontrollably. And what had happened, Greg, on land was a small boat that had a tarp over it that was the same color of the body bags that she had been putting patients into. And she saw every one of their faces and remembered every one of their names. These are the traumas that these folks who serve us are experiencing. We have a responsibility, just like with our military, to honor, thank, and support them. Hmm.
I want to mention something else from Emily Grace's story that I think is worth our talking about, and it's certainly a theme that is important in the overall book, and that is the importance of reflection. At one point in Emily Grace's story, she writes this: I live close enough to the hospital to drive to work. The trip only takes about 15 minutes, but I actually leave about an hour early on most days, especially during this period of upheaval in our lives. That extra 45 minutes allowed me to prepare myself mentally for what lay ahead. It reminded me of something else in your book when you write this: heroes do not have the luxury of reflection while in the midst of the battle. The true reflection has to happen in a safe and trusting environment. Tell us more about the importance of reflection, of how elusive it can be when one is in the midst of experiencing stress and trauma, and how important it is to try to nevertheless find moments for it.
Yeah, you know, I wasn't good in school. I played basketball at the high school and college level, and I thought my middle name was Izzy Eligible, because that's what the coach kept saying. Is he still eligible? Can he still play? And so I use formulas really don't resonate in my head, like X plus Y equals Z kind of formulas. But this formula that I came up with, I think, will underline what we're speaking about. Experiences plus intellectual readiness plus reflection equals development, growth. In order to have development and growth, think about experiential learning. We get that whether we like it or not. We're going to get experiential learning as we go through life. And at times we get a test without knowing what the material is. It comes as a result of hard knocks. And then the second part is intellectual readiness, the actual studying of a subject. That's given to us as well with elementary, middle, high school, and then decisions made about furthering formal education. But intellectual readiness is studying of a subject. I do know that without reflection, coupled with those first two, we're not going to have development and growth. And yet we are not taught how to reflect. We're not a reflective society. You can imagine you're sitting at your desk and you got your feet up on the desk. You're looking out the window. The boss walks by and says, what are you doing? Oh, I'm reflecting, ma'am. That's not going to go over, Vic. We're doers in this life. And finding time and underlining that self-care does not mean selfish. We need to take care of ourselves in order to be the best version of ourselves in order to make this world a better place. So reflection, to me, is extremely important, and taking time to reflect. And my hope is, before your listeners put their head in the pillow tonight, they reflect on some of the things we're speaking about.
Of course. I want to talk about the story that is shared in your book from a Dr. A.J. Jung, Y-U-N-G, interim director of the Hospitalists Group in Texas. One of the things that he describes that he very much experienced in the position that he had at the time of the onset of the COVID-19 pandemic was the flood of anxious questions and inquiries that came in from all kinds of different people with all kinds of different worries and stresses and concerns. And coupled with all of that was the way in which the onset of the pandemic changed everything in terms of the healthcare landscape in our country, and the shutting down of certain facets of medical practice that suddenly just were impossible to do for one reason or another. I guess I had forgotten, and maybe have never fully appreciated, this wrenching aspect of the COVID-19 pandemic, the way in which so much changed in the whole sector of medical care, and how that was difficult and traumatic, not just for us in the outside world, but for those delivering medical care who suddenly found so many things utterly changed. That's kind of a different sort of trauma apart from the actual, you know, dealing with death and dealing with suffering. Just dealing with this level of monumental change had to be a grueling trauma all its own.
It's unsettling, right? I mean, you can imagine, like, you go into your studio, and that's your office. And you go in, but for someone else to go and do what you do, it would be so unsettling. It would be like, how do I do this? And yet, because you have a comfort level, that allows you to be focused on doing your job in sharing stories and sharing information with your listeners. Matt, I always like to look into what is taking place in a society and how it impacts those who we look to. So that disruption that was taking place worldwide was also taking place within the medical organizations. They're trying to figure out at the same time. So one of the things that I fly a lot, I have 6 million miles in the year between the major airlines. When that plane starts bouncing around up there, I'd like to hear from the pilot. You know, I don't like the silence. I'd like to hear the pilot say, we're going to go through this turbulence for the next 3 minutes. Then you have a beginning, middle, and an end kind of expectation. But if you don't hear anything, you're wondering, are they in the panic up there? Is everything going all right here? And I think that takes place within folks who are charged with the responsibility to take care of and lead us through situations. And I think that was going on in the medical field as well. They're still human beings, and they're going to hear rumors, and they're going to have different varying opinions of how things should be taking place. All of that are added stressors, and it just underlines that heroes are human.
Absolutely. And they need care, and they need, in many cases, they need for us to care about them and to understand their plight, and they need to be cared for, and they need to care for themselves to whatever extent it is possible. I want to make sure to mention that at the very end of your book, is a really interesting trauma self-care pocket card that we see reprinted, which evidently is distributed at certain workshops and so on. Would you mind just kind of summarizing what this is and just maybe a couple of the most basic points or strategies of self-care when we're talking about this kind of trauma?
Yeah, as I mentioned earlier, Dr. Malika is the director of the Harvard Global Mental Health Trauma Recovery, and he provided this self-care pocket card in the course that I attended, and then I present on a video presentation, 21 minute on self-care, and use this as a backdrop. Dr. Greg Frischioni, Sonia Graziano, and Eugene Augustifer are the authors of this. And it's from all that they have studied and worked with folks in the healthcare community. And they talk about self-care. They talk about peer supervision, empathy, reflection, mindfulness, nature. And nature is so important. Nature is a part of self-care. You think about your house pets. If you have a cat or a dog, they become startled. They jump around. And then they go back to their normal life shortly after that. Yet what do? We get an email that comes in and we have a mock battle going on, ready to attack without even really understanding because we're reading it in a certain way. This nature was underlined to me in Iraq and Afghanistan. One of the things that the military leaders wanted me to understand is when a soldier was hit in either one of those battlefields, how they're cared for. And so there's a field hospital, and then they either go to down to Baghdad or in Iraq or over to Bagram in Afghanistan. And the first one I went to, we were up in Mosul, and I'm getting a tour by a doctor at the field hospital, and I said, "It's all good, doc, but who takes care of you?" And he looked at me and smiled, and he walked me in the back area, and outside that field hospital was a small patch of green grass that was obviously cared for in the desert. There was a stick with rocks on it, and if you took a pitcher of water and poured it over the top, it sounded like a babbling brook. He said, "When things get too tough, my staff and I come out here, and we get around this to reset." I said the same thing to the doctor giving me the tour in Afghanistan. "It's all good, doc. Who's taking care of you?" She said, "Take a walk with me." We went up on the rooftop, and we looked out at snow-capped mountains in Afghanistan. And she said, "When things get too tough, we come up here, we reset. Because when we look at those mountains, we're in Denver or we're in Utah." And so seeing how nature can help us in self-care, it's not a 10-step program. While there's 10 identifiers on this card, there's an understanding that post-trauma need not be a lifelong sentence, but it may be a lifelong journey of healing.
Your book again is Heroes Are Human: Lessons in Resilience, Courage, and Wisdom from the COVID Front Lines, featuring an array of fascinating and moving and uplifting stories from various people on the so-called front lines of this crisis. The book is published by City Point Press, the author Bob Delaney. Bob Delaney, thank you so much for writing this book, for giving it to the world, and for joining me on the morning show to talk about it. Very best wishes to you.
Thank you. Stay safe.
The time is 8:48 here on WGTD. Tomorrow on the morning show, we're going to be talking about The Wizard of Oz, chiefly about the production of The Wizard of Oz that is opening Friday night at the Rhodey Opera House in downtown Kenosha with the Lakeside Players. I speak with Colin Swanson and China Chung, who are co-stage directors, and Brian Chung, the music director for this production. And then we will listen back to a couple of interesting interviews from the archives, one of them with somebody who appeared in the beloved film in 1939, Meinhard Rabi, who played the coroner and has written a memoir called Memories of a Munchkin. And you'll hear that, an excerpt from that conversation from many years ago, tomorrow as well, that portion of the conversation where Mr. Robbie recalls appearing as one of the Munchkins in the Wizard of Oz film. And we'll finish out the program with an excerpt from a really interesting conversation with Randall McLowry and Tracy Heath Stein about their fascinating American Experience documentary about L. Frank Baum, which is called American Oz.